This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Welcome, folks, back to Whitley Strieber's legendary Dreamland podcast, a long-running and deeply penetrating program that has helped explore and define the UFO subject for decades. This strange voice you're hearing now is me, James Falk, founder and host of the Neon Galactic podcast, and now a monthly guest MC on Dreamland, literally a dreamland come true. If you'd like to get to know me and my work, you can find Neon Galactic on YouTube, Patreon, or wherever you get your podcasts. But it's an honor, beyond words, to be in this seat, helping to build with you all an understanding of how magnificent and complex this universe is, how ill-contained by limited dogmatic thinking, and how open it is to our engagement. So, let's engage. Our guest today is a scientist, physicist, Dr. Kevin Knuth, from the State University of New York at Albany, who has himself become a well-known figure in ufology, someone who works tirelessly to anchor the study of UAPs within the realms of rigor and hard science, doing his best to unburden this field from its past investigatory habits and establish a new paradigm of UAP research. Yet he's also someone who doesn't deny the strangeness of all this, the ontological flips it generates, the confrontation so often engendered between who someone was and what they become after brushing up against this phenomenon. Therein lies a mystery, among others, that may yet serve to transform us all. By braiding the threads of science, technology, consciousness, philosophy, and the human psyche, can we weave a rope strong enough to rappel down into the deep questions without getting so tangled up we ultimately hang ourselves? There's only one way to find out. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
I'm a fan of yours, as a lot of people are. You represent, I think, sort of the quintessential combination of things that we desperately need in this subject in terms of a hard science background, a willingness to, kind of put yourself out there as an investigator and look for rigor, but at the same time, not dismissing out of hand things that might seem to, belie conventional explanation. You're willing to engage with the mystery, and I think that that's absolutely pivotal for where we're at and where we may be headed as a species. Let's start with who Kevin Knuth is. And I wanted to kind of, ask about your love of science. I know you're an educator, so you're passionate about it. And your job is to basically infect young students with that similar passion. Talk about what brought you into science and what it is you love about the deep fundamental questions.
I think what I love the most, I mean, what really drives me is I have this insatiable curiosity as to what is all this about? What's actually happening here? Who are we? Where do we live? What is the universe actually like? I mean, that is what's driven me pretty much my whole life. And, been confused from by this as a child, like, where did all this come from? What is all this about? What is happening here? And I think that's really what science should be about. And I have colleagues who are scientists who share that passion. Not all of them do, surprisingly. For many of them, it's a job, which just befuddles me. I'm like, this universe is amazing, and there are amazing things that happen, and I really want to understand that.
Yeah. When did you know that you wanted to go into science as a career? Was there a particular, question that amazed you as a kid and kind of brought you in, or was it just your general curiosity? What brought you into the fold?
Oh, that's hard to know if there's any one point. Both of my parents were interested in science. My mom was very good at mathematics. She was a nurse, and at home she had hobbies of quilting, but she also really pushed me to study mathematics, which was good. I remember she for a high school project, she made like the platonic solids out of paper, figured out how to fold them and make and things like that. She was very proud of that, I remember. And both my parents were interested in science. My father was a wildlife artist. He also worked with troubled kids and autistic adults at some point later on. But he was a wildlife artist and always loved wildlife. I learned bird watching from him starting at age 4. So I've been a bird watcher all my life. I'm used to identifying unidentified objects in the sky. So
You know if the wings are flapping, right?
I can tell the difference. I
Yeah.
mean, when people say it's a gull, I've seen 21 species of gulls. I can tell whether it's a gull or not. And go fast, not a gull. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm a lifelong
Thank you
bird.
for that.
It does not fly with me, literally. And so, yeah, but my dad was always interested in nature and wildlife, and we used to, every summer we would, when I was older, starting around 5th grade, we would have a new project. Like one summer we decided to learn about and identify snails. So we drove around to different lakes because you have different species of snails in different lakes, which I did not know until, we started doing that. And we
Yeah.
started collecting snails' shells and identifying them. And then the next year we learned about clams, and we would go dredging for clams. Clams live in rivers. Snails live in lakes. Clams are not really lake mollusks. They're mostly river,
Yeah.
which is also interesting. So,
Yeah.
and studied birds, clams, snails, grasses, learned to identify different grasses, flowers. And so I've always been interested in wildlife, and he was always interested in teaching me about all sorts of weird things. I mean, I remember there was a Sasquatch or Bigfoot sighting up in Fremont, Wisconsin. I grew up in Wisconsin, and we drove up there to look for it one day,
Oh,
which
that's cool.
after the
Yeah.
sighting, yeah, we drove looking for it. I mean, we didn't find anything, of course,
Yeah,
but
well,
and we
that's
didn't really
the
expect
conundrum
to. It
there.
was just mostly a fun outing, right? But
Yeah.
I mean, but he was always open to these sorts of things, and he was interested in relativity. I remember him telling me about relativity when I was in maybe 6th grade or so. And he had the book. I don't have my shelves up here because we've just remodeled our basement, but my study here is still being put back together. But I had Einstein's and Infeld's. Leopold Infeld and Albert Einstein wrote a popular book on relativity that my dad owned, and I read that in 7th grade. And
Wow, precocious kid.
well, it's a popular book, so it's
Okay, well,
for normal
still.
people to read, okay? But still for a seventh
Yeah,
grader, I guess. But
no.
And so it doesn't help when though when you're in science class and the teacher says something like, well, matter mass doesn't exactly disappear. It doesn't really when it's converted energy. Like, no, the mass actually goes away. Yes. I remember arguing with my teacher, which does not endear you to your teachers. You have to be careful with that. And I was
Right.
careful to do it in front of the other students because you didn't want to make the teacher look bad. But
Sensitive,
my
sensitive.
science teacher was not, that particular science teacher, that was my 8th grade teacher, was not particularly on top of relativity. But I remember my 7th grade teacher, from which I had biology, Mr. Smedberg, was John Smedberg. He was amazing. The first day he said, we're going to learn about different trees. We're going to learn how to identify trees and leaves. And he said, and I don't know anything about this, so I'm going to learn it with you. And that impressed me. I was like, oh my
Yeah,
God, he's going to
yeah,
learn this with us. And we did, and it was great fun. So,
yeah. The whole learning experience together is something that is not too
yeah, you
often
don't you have
embraced.
this when you're a kid, you have this idea that your teachers know everything. We don't know everything. In fact, I've at this point, I'm now that I'm studying, I've been studying UAP for what, 7 years now or something, starting in about like 2019, I guess, just after the New York Times article came out. So
Yeah.
yeah, so a little more than 5 years now, and but I've just turned 60 this year, and I realized that after being a physicist for 30 years, I don't have a clue how the universe works. I really don't.
Yeah.
I've learned about all sorts of weird things that I just can't explain and don't have any idea how they work. And at one level, it's a little frustrating. I think I wish I would have expected to have gotten a little further at this point, but I'm being introduced to things that people don't study, which is interesting. And It's very easy to believe that we understand everything when you only study things that we understand.
Yeah. I
That's
read a book one time
important.
talking about presentism, which is basically thinking that any point in the present, in science, often throughout history, we've always kind of thought that we're right around the corner from figuring everything out. And it
Yeah.
seems like one of the great things that the UAP subject has to teach us is humility, right? Like all the things that we think we know, I mean, we're just muddling in whatever our particular sensory sphere is of the universe, and that doesn't. It's not privileged. There's realms above us and below us and all around us that we can't even interact with. So how can we presume to say that we've got it all figured out when all of those, universes, so to speak, are remain untouched by us? Which is interesting because that leads into the
We're
next
still learning,
question.
which is fine. I mean, but it's important to recognize that. And
Yeah,
that's
that was my sort of my next question. I mean, in terms of, this is sort of far afield a little bit, but it's going to come back into it, I promise. This, what are the conundrums that science is facing right now? I mean, besides the UAP topic, although that is a part of what I see as problematic within science, what are the issues that we're facing where that function is kind of like blinders, keeping us from seeing things or engaging with a phenomenon in a way that might provide a different kind of insight? Do you see anything there that is like systematic
That's an
or?
interesting question. I mean, there are the obvious things that we know that we don't understand well. Quantum mechanics and gravity, we have two theories of each of those, and the two theories don't get along. We can't put them together. So we know, and that I think that's an important thing to keep in mind that a lot of scientists don't appreciate, is that we know we don't know everything. And that's already very clear to some of us. And so when we encounter weird stuff with UFOs, and people say, oh, well, we know everything and that doesn't seem possible. I'm like, well, we don't actually know everything and we know we don't.
Yeah.
So that's one of the obvious ones, dark matter, dark energy. The evidence for dark matter suggests that 15 ohm, that. The observable universe, everything we know about, only comprises 15% of what's there.
Which
I
is
mean,
all that we can see and apparently engage with. So we're
and
walking
engage
around
with,
and,
yeah, not just
yeah,
seeing, but engage with in any, interact with it in any way.
that's
That
a
means
very
that,
small slice.
but, and that's, and when you think, and it takes, it's worth some effort to think about that. It means that what's in the room with you right now, what you see in the room with you right now, you're only seeing 15% of it. You're only interacting with 15% of it. 85% of what's here, you don't know anything about.
So that's a
Wow.
question, though. I mean,
That's a
just real
lot of
quick.
ignorance out there. That's a little concerning,
It
right?
is, but for a lot of people, they think of that as out there. Like, 85% of the stuff that
Not
it's the
right in
stuff
front
that's
of
out
your
there.
face, right
It's
here.
so that's all existing around us.
Yeah, around you all the time.
Wow, see,
And
that
that's
raises a lot of
mind-blowing.
questions. Yes,
And
totally.
then, so let's take it to another level. If you only know about 15% of the universe, if that's all you can interact with, you're the anomaly.
Yeah.
We're actually the anomaly here. We're the 15%. Everything you see here is the anomaly.
Yeah.
So, what is the actual, when beginning of the podcast, I said, I want to know what the universe is like. I haven't seen 85% of it in my house, even. Right. So I have no idea what the universe is like.
Yeah.
I only know what the anomaly is like. I only know what this 15% is like. And that's humbling. And that's, I think, an important perspective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that sort of gets at, how I think the UAP topic is just the top layer or the most visible layer of this great sort of fundamental mystery that we're all trying to, I mean, people in this subject are trying to point, some attention toward. And wind us back from this idea that we are, so close to figuring things out. Yeah, I think that's an important point.
And I think the other thing that the other frontier has to do, I don't want to use the word consciousness. I don't like using that word because it's
Okay, fair enough.
when I as a postdoc, I studied neuroscience for what from 95 to about 1995 till around 2002 or 2003, and then I tapered off and went back to physics. But I studied neuroscience for that time, and We called it the C word. You didn't study in the 90s. You didn't study consciousness. That was not allowed
Yeah.
in neuroscience. And now it's more popular. But we called it the C word back then. You don't study that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's an interesting. It's interesting that that's now being studied more, which is good. But I think that we still don't treat that as seriously as we ought to. We tend to belittle the human experience.
Yeah.
People say they experience something and we just belittle it, right? And especially when it's weird. And that's not really reasonable when you are human and the most important thing to you should be the human experiences, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
why do we belittle the thing that's actually most important to us? It's a very strange way of thinking, and there's something very wrong with our perspective there as well.
Yeah, it's interesting with the consciousness question. I remember, sorry for using the word, I don't mean to swear.
No, it's all right.
But
It's a technical term. It's all
yeah, right.
right.
Bernardo Castrop talks about ontological primitives, where you look at the root of everything that we know, and everything we've ever experienced, have ever anything remotely human, has to come through the initial filter or genesis of consciousness. So it's always a fundamental part of what we're experiencing. And then Donald Hoffman talks about how our consciousness is actually may just sort of be a user interface that allows us to kind of interact with whatever reality may actually be. And in both of those two ideas, it's fundamental, no matter how you consider it. But there's still a lot of folks out there who think it's a what do you call it when it's basically a well, what's that term? Epiphenomenon. There it is. A lot of syllables. That it's just something that we can, it's kind of illusion, that it's just it rises out of the natural processes of the human brain and doesn't actually amount to much. It sounds like that's not what you think about it. But there, at the same time, there are a lot of leaps that get made with the term consciousness and sort of this topic and other topics that have to do with sort of metaphysics. What do you think about some of those things? I mean, is that also similarly problematic to your
I
mind?
think it's hard. I think we have a lot to learn in that respect. And I think that I know basically nothing about it. I mean,
Yeah.
less than the 15% of what's in this room. Yeah.
Now, so you teach at the State University of New York in physics. We were talking about your history and how you ended up a scientist. Was it the math with your mother that made you sort of open to it, or the early Einstein book? What got you into physics, which is really the
I
most
think it
massive
was. I think it
questions?
was. I think it was the book written by Einstein, and just discussing that with my father. I think I was really struck by the concepts of length contraction and time dilation that happen when you're moving at very high speeds, and the fact that different people will observe different effects, but they're all consistent.
Yeah.
And that's interesting too. I mean, this in some
Yeah.
sense this goes back to the whole observer business, which is related to consciousness, right? I mean, the
Yeah.
you're so if you're traveling in a spaceship across the galaxy at close to the speed of light, for the people in the galaxy, they look at your ship and they see your time is going slowly, and you look at them and you see their time is going slowly, but then they look at your spaceship and it's squished, length contracted, so it's very thin, pancake thin. And you look at the galaxy and the galaxy is squished. So how do you traverse the galaxy in a reasonable period of time at close to the speed of light? Well, it's very easy. For you, the traveler, the galaxy is squished in length and you don't have very far to go.
Yeah.
For the people outside the galaxy, they see your spaceship squished, but your clock's going slowly, so you can travel 85,000 years across the galaxy and it doesn't seem like much time for you. So, two totally different effects, but they're still together, they're consistent. And I always found that fascinating.
Yeah. And n neither one of those spheres is privileged, right? They're all equally true within their
They're
own
all equally
realms.
true. That's right. Yeah.
which is another fascinating part of it. But it sounds like, I mean, from early on, and that's, it's interesting too that you mentioned those things, because those are two issues that come up, I think, in the UAP topic, right? Like, I mean, faster than light
Yeah,
travel,
which
what that
I
looks
thought they
like.
would be good examples for that reason, yeah, because they come up with the whole problem of interstellar travel, right?
Yeah. But it sounds like from early on, you were intrigued by these sort of fundamental questions about the nature of reality and what we're in and all of that. How, I mean, given your education and your career and where you've come and where you've gone since then, how do you think we're doing as a species with those questions?
Oof. There are times when I think we've done exceptionally well. And there are times when I think we're just morons. And I don't really know what the answer is. I think we've come a very long way. I think this is that what we're doing in learning about what the universe is actually like, I think this is hard to do. I think it's fundamentally difficult to do, and I think the fact that we've made any progress at all is admirable. I don't think we've made as much progress as a lot of my colleagues would like to think. And I think that we eventually, when we learn, if we ever learn what the universe is actually like, I think we're going to be shocked. But I think
So,
it's a hard thing to do. Yeah.
yeah. Was it, do you think that it was your interest in those big questions or your frustration maybe on in some level of where we've gotten to that really landed you in the UAP topic? Let's talk about how you mentioned the 2017 New York Times report. Lou Elizondo comes out. There's the story and there's, all of the hubbub that happened. It was a cultural moment for sure. How did you get drawn into it from there? And, what led you to actually want to apply your education to this question?
Right. I got into it kind of in a awkward way. It would have to go back to when I started in graduate school. I grew up in Wisconsin and I moved to Montana. I went to got my bachelor's degree at University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And then I got into graduate school at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. And I had just moved out to Montana. It was within the first 2 weeks of classes, so this would have been September of 1988, and there was a cattle mutilation on one of the ranches in Bozeman. And that night, there were tons of UFO reports called into the sheriff's office, and then there were these two cows were mutilated. It was a classic cattle mutilation. When they described it on the news, it was pretty disgusting and confusing. It's like, why would anybody do this? And of course, out in Montana, the TV news was, had two solutions. It was either aliens did this or Satanists, right? I mean, as if those were the only two possibilities. And I remember I
Satanic
joked
panic.
on. Yeah, I joked on another podcast. I think Danny Jones recently, I joked with him. I said, nobody ever thought to put the two together, Satanist aliens or something or something. But it was like these two possibilities, right? It was very weird. And so the next day in class at the university, I was with some of the other graduate students who had also just moved there, and I think we were all heard about this on the news and we were like, WTF, why, what is this even about? And so we were discussing this in the hallway, and it was a very heated conversation. And I remember asking, how would a Satanist do this, and why would an alien do this? And I remember saying that much. That's as far as I was able to get in my head. And it was a heated conversation in the hallway, and we clearly bothered one of the physics professors down the hall, and he came out of his office to see what was going on, and he told us, he explained, well, yeah, this happens here from time to time, and there's often UFO reports, and no one really knows, and they try to study it and try to figure it out, but no one ever gets anywhere, and then eventually they forget about it until it happens again, right?
There's some
And we
deep
were like,
truth
wow,
there.
that's not very comforting. And as for the new students, we're trying to figure out what kind of crazy place did we just move to, and are going to have to spend the next 4 or 5 years here. And And so after he told us this, though, he goes, "But you know what's really weird?" He said, "I have some friends who work at the Air Force Base up in Malmstrom Air Force Base up in northern Montana, and they have problems with UFOs flying over the ICBM sites and shutting down the nuclear missiles."
So you heard about that
And
earlier.
he told us this, and we listened politely. And when he walked away, we laughed because, and we discussed this. I mean, we thought this is silly because if UFOs are actually shutting down nuclear missiles, this would be the biggest national security emergency ever, right? So it's got to be ridiculous, is what we thought. And so that kind of became a running joke for that year. Whenever anything weird happened, somebody would say, "Oh, this weird thing happened," and we would jump in and say, "Yeah, but what's even weirder is UFOs are shutting down nuclear missiles," and we all would laugh. And so that was what, 30 years ago, right? So now fast forward, and I'm teaching an astronomy class here at University at Albany in New York. And I was preparing for a lecture on astrobiology, the possibility of life elsewhere. And some of the students had asked me beforehand, "Can you talk about the possibility of aliens visiting Earth?" And I didn't know what to say about that. I mean, it's, other than talk about the Fermi paradox and the Drake equation. And so it was like 1 a.m. and I'm just poking around on the internet trying to get some idea. Can I say anything intelligent about this, or is it just nonsensical? And I stumbled on a YouTube, like a YouTube channel with Robert Hastings. It was his
UFOs
press
and nukes.
conference at the National Press Club in 2010. Sorry, I was trying to put all that together in my mind.
No, I
And
appreciate it.
it was his 2010. So this is back. So this my class I was teaching was like 2015. So it's a couple years before the New York Times article, and I stumbled on the Robert Hastings press conference, and it consisted of maybe six people. Robert Salas was the first one to speak from Malmstrom Air Force Base about UFOs shutting down nuclear missiles, and I was like, "Whoa, whoa. Wait a minute, I heard about this 30 years ago." And it hadn't been in the news since, and there wasn't internet back when I heard about it. So this wasn't widely known, right? I thought I heard about this 30 years ago, and I start listening, and I'm like, "Holy cow, this has got to be real." I mean, it just kind of sank into my mind that this is a real thing, and this is a real problem. And what really impacted me was the fact that I could see how nobody believed it was an emergency because it's so hard to believe.
Your initial reflex as a rational person is to just kind of make a joke and dismiss it because it
Which
seems
is what
like,
we did back in grad school, yeah.
yeah, like
And
it would be
but then
the
you
story
hear
of the
about this,
century.
and then you realize that Robert Salas is talking about the events he's talking about happened in 1966, 20 years before I heard about it as an ongoing problem in 1988. And I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. Nobody makes this stuff up for 20 years. This is a whole different level of something." And so I think the urgency sank in. And so I thought, somebody needs to look into this. So I started paying attention. That basically got my attention, right? And so I started paying attention, and I had been paying attention and reading about UFOs and this for a couple years before, just before the 2017 New York Times article that Helene Cooper, Ralph Blumenthal, and Leslie Kane wrote. And when that came out, I was like, "Holy cow, this is all real." And this is somebody, and I thought, somebody needs to actually study this. Scientists need to be on board with this. This is a big deal. And that's when the New York Times article came out, I thought, "Well, why don't you do it? I mean, why shouldn't I do it? Why should I just point my finger and say they should? Neil deGrasse Tyson should get on this. I mean, it's not clearly not going to get on this, but or
That guy, anyway.
Michio Kaku in when he's in A Tear in the Sky that we're in, and he says, he goes, "It's about time." I'm like, "Well," and every time I hear and see this that movie and I hear him say that, I think, "Well, why wasn't Michio Kaku studying it? Why?"
Everyone wants to pass the buck, except you took up the charge.
But I felt the urgency, and so I didn't. I didn't pass the buck. I decided, well, let's see what I can do. And I worked on, I thought the first thing I can do is I can at least look at a few cases and maybe estimate speeds and accelerations and get some idea of how anomalous these things are.
Yeah.
And so then I ended up writing the paper on characterizing, flight characteristics of UAP. And I had that paper and presented it and published that. So that's basically how it started.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll come back in a few seconds and we'll continue this conversation.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind, totally new, incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
The key. What can it mean? He came in the night. A long time ago, 1998, in a hotel in Toronto. And he said some of the most amazing things I have ever heard. In 1998, he warned us about climate change. The book Superstorm came from his warning. In 1998, he warned us about artificial intelligence. He said, if I was an intelligent machine, I would deceive you. He said many other things. About God, about the nature of being human, about this journey of life, useful, valuable, wise things. I asked him about sin. He said sin is denial of the right to thrive. I have been thinking about that ever since. A profoundly wise man came out of the night and disappeared into the night, leaving behind the key. And you can get it now, the original edition, a signed collector's item. They will run out. Go to the unknowncountry.com store to get your signed copy of the key today.
Back with Professor Kevin Newth from the University of New York, or State University of New York at Albany. Thanks for being on the show. I wanted to pick up where we left off with you deciding that the topic was something that you wanted to take a hold of rather than just pass the buck like so many others have done throughout history. And I know that you have done a lot over the intervening years with UAPX and writing papers and your research. Let's talk a little bit about what you think are the highlights of, where the science has gone since those early days of 2017, and then ultimately getting into what's most exciting about the science in this moment. So, I mean, what do you
oh,
think
that's
that
all,
of? Go ahead.
That's all very good. Yeah, and let me just add that that I don't think Michio Kaku was just passing the buck. I didn't mean to sound like that. So if it comes off that way, that's not at all what I intended. I really appreciate the fact that he's willing to talk about the topic and be open about it and open-minded. I think that's an important thing.
Yeah, that's a service in itself. I mean, honestly, in this culture,
it really is, especially, among when you consider other scientists. So I think we're in an exciting time. I think that it wasn't just, me interested in studying this. I think there were a number of scientists who, who saw that article and saw what happened shortly after and thought, wow, this really does need to be studied. This is interesting. So, so where do things stand now? Where they stand now is there's a few different groups that involve academic scientists at universities. I mean, this is really wonderful and admirable. It's amazing that we can actually do this when you consider how taboo the topic had been.
Yeah.
So we have our group at the University at Albany,
UAPX, right?
Matthew Chittagas and Cecilia Levy have been working with UAPX, which was founded by Kevin Day and Gary Voorhees and Jason Turner. They were all in the Navy at the, you know, during the Nimitz encounters. So we've worked with them. You've got the Galileo Project at Harvard, which is not far from here, and Wes Waters, who has his sub project on Celeste, which was, he's developing equipment to study UAP as well. And you have Hakan Kayal at the University of Würzburg in Germany. And they've been talking about putting, you know, imaging equipment on satellites and actually putting putting equipment on Mars to watch for UAPs on Mars. I mean, that's a cool idea. I don't know.
That is a fantastic idea.
It'd be awesome if you could pull that off. That's really pretty amazing. And you've got Beatrix Villarreal, who's in Sweden,
yes,
who's studying old photographic plates, looking for objects in orbit. So it's we've got a good number of academics trying to study UAPs. Gary Nolan at Stanford has been working to study materials, do material analysis. My colleague Matthew Chittagas at University at Albany has also been studying materials as well. So we now have that going on too. And
quite the arsenal of bright minds doing the work.
Yeah, so we've got several, you know, several academic groups at different universities who are working somewhat independently, but we know each other. We communicate. I mean, we're scientists. This is what you do. You communicate with each other. We share information. We talk about the equipment we're using. We talk about findings. We talk about difficulties and how we can do better. And there's now different coalitions, like the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, which is, you know, has people like Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell and others. So scientists meet up there and talk about UAPs. You've got the Society for UAP Studies, SUAPS, you know, which was founded by Mike Safone.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be giving the J. Allen Hynek lecture for SUAPS this coming weekend, this coming Saturday.
Wow.
Which is free and open to the public. You can sign up and register and hear, listen to me talk for another hour and a half or so.
A paper that recently came out that you were an author of, and I think a lot of the people that you just mentioned were an author of, is The New Science of Unidentified Aerospace and Undersea Phenomenon. And you talk about, you know, the evolution of this science over the past intervening years. What would you say are some of the highlights of what that paper had to present? And because it was sort of a state of the science and the history and how the methodology may have to change in order to sort of move this subject beyond just substantiating its existence to actually accruing data that can be used for scientific analysis. Is that fair, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And in fact, I think you hit on a key point in that one of the things that science does, science tries to rule out hypotheses. You don't really confirm or prove anything. You're ruling out other hypotheses until there's only one thing left, you know, kind of like Sherlock Holmes does, right? And a pseudoscience is a bit different. In pseudoscience, you're trying to prove a hypothesis. You focus on that hypothesis and you try to prove it. And I think that's where the study of UFOs and UAPs had difficulty in the beginning. And I think the study of anything weird or unusual has that difficulty in the beginning, because you have to first convince people that this is an interesting phenomenon to study. So you have to prove that it's real, right? And that makes you look like a pseudoscience, no matter what that thing is.
Yeah.
If you're going to study the germ theory of disease, you've got to prove germs are real, and you've got to prove they cause disease before you can actually study them.
Yeah.
And so almost all sciences, when they start, go through this weird pseudoscience, this awkward pseudoscience phase. And that it can last for a long time. The study of continental drift it took about 100 years for that to become an actual study. It didn't really become serious until after Apollo astronauts put laser reflectors on the moon, and we could actually measure how fast the continents were moving. It took that to be able
Yeah.
to then treat that as an actual topic of study. I mean, however, kids all around the world, I mean, I noticed this. I got my first globe at like age 5, for Christmas. I got a big metal globe. We all notice South America fits right into
Fits right
Africa.
in puzzle pieces, right?
Every kid spots that, right?
Yeah.
But it took 100 years for science to get on board.
Yeah.
That's telling, and it shows how. So, in some sense, science is very conservative, right? Science is very conservative and very careful.
Yeah.
They don't just jump to conclusions or jump on a hypothesis. And in some sense, that's good. That means you can trust science to be correct in many cases. But it also means science is really slow. It's slow to accept new ideas and slow to change. And that's problematic at times. And so there's difficulties there. So what's happened now is we've shifted the 2017 New York Times article, along with the release of the three Navy videos, and the fact that the Navy felt a need to get Congress involved because they were having, in 2015, they were having near daily encounters with UAPs and needed Congress involved to be able to do something. Those factors happening about the same time were enough to convince some people that this was real and needed to be dealt with. And that gave us the breathing room where we don't have to prove it's real right now.
Yeah.
We can instead dive in and start studying it. And the now looking back, it's a good thing because it's a good thing people did dive in and started studying it and started writing papers, because those papers now start to establish it as a science.
Yeah.
And so now we have published papers that published academic peer-reviewed papers that we can point to and say, no, this is a science. And we can go forward from there. So
Intellectual momentum, you might call it. I mean, in terms
we
of,
made it past
yeah.
that awkward pseudoscience stage. We got past that awkward pseudoscience stage. And now that means scientists can get involved and actually study it. Now the downside to this is that scientists have been ruining all the fun for what, 400 years, since the 1600s. I mean, we really are the least fun people, because we Because if there is a prosaic explanation that's correct, we will find it.
Yeah, well,
And
that's the goal. I mean,
but the goal is to find the truth, right? And
yeah.
so in some cases, we're going to get debris that we want to analyze, and we're going to end, at least in one case already, debris that I helped look at. We found it was an airplane. It was an actual airplane. It was not a crashed UFO. I'm sorry. Yes, that's not fun. It's not interesting. They're not as interesting.
Yeah. But you
And
get it out of the way and you excuse that question and you move on to the next one and the next one.
then we
And I
look at the
mean,
next one and the next one. And not all the debris that has been looked at is not interesting. Some of it's fascinating and clearly not airplanes. And that's what Matthew Shadaga is working on right now. So I don't want to talk about his work without him here. But he's already found some amazing things, and I think that that's going to continue to happen. So in some
That's
sense, we
exciting.
scientists are going to ruin the fun, because not all unidentified objects are alien spacecraft. We already knew this, but we scientists are going to point that out again and again and again and again and again until there's a lot of disappointed people out there. Sorry, but some of them appear that they might be. And so those are the ones we want to focus on, and that's where you really want to focus your energies.
Now, the Terror in the Sky, you mentioned that it was a movie that you were prominently featured in, as was UAPX. You guys were on a rooftop, I think, in Southern California, and
On the
looking
beach.
at and you spent a few days there and had all your science gear laid out, and it was fascinating to watch science at work. I'm interested, can you give us a sort of an overview of what you think is exciting about what your group has discovered, both through that process, but then in the years since? What can you point to as this is really exciting, or is it more of the important work of saying, okay, well, that's not anomalous, but that's important that we recognize that that's also true. I mean,
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard, and I remember saying this one to Matthew Chedagas when we arrived in Laguna Beach and first went up on the rooftop. We were both very excited. Oh, this is going to be so much fun. I wonder what we're going to see. And I remember being a real downer, and I said, "Yeah, but you know what we're really going to learn here? We're going to learn what not to do in trying to study UFOs. That's what we're really going to learn here. We're going to learn how to do everything wrong."
That's the birth of a scientific objective or a scientific
But
field,
that's how you
right? I
get
mean,
better. I mean, that's really how you improve and you get better. And that's true. That's exactly what actually happened. Now, you didn't get to see all that in the movie because the movie is short term, you don't learn. So, a spoiler alert, one of the first things that we spotted that was spotted by the Catalina team was a bright white light moving in the sky. It was brighter than a satellite. It moved for a while and then literally just disappeared. And so that's featured in the movie. A lot of excitement around this, and we later figured out that that was the International Space Station. We actually, so yes, spoiler. It's a real spoiler. Yeah, it would have been cool for it to be a cool alien spacecraft that then disappeared, right? But no, it went behind the Terminator of the Earth. It went inside, behind the shadow of the Earth, and then stopped reflecting sunlight, and you can't see it anymore. And Matthew Chedagas recognized it as such. The apps we were using on our phones to identify satellites, the app we had was did not take into account daylight savings time, so they were all off by an hour. That was a mistake. That was a big mistake. We never checked beforehand that the app was going to do what it advertised to do, right? But so that was one of our mistakes. But Matthew identified it as the space station, and then went as far in the paper we published, went as far to look at the imagery that we got of it and count the number of pixels and estimate its size. He estimated it to be 110 feet across, given the known altitude of the space station, and it turns out it's what, 111 feet, or he was off by a foot.
Wow. Well,
I mean,
that's reassuring actually for his
it's
analytical
fantastic. I
capabilities.
mean, that's what you hope for as a scientist, to be able to we not only identified it, we actually measured its size and very accurately. So I mean, that's really a good job.
And he's not afraid to, kind of put a thumbnail or a thumbtack in the excitement to be real about what's actually going on. So when something does get announced by UAPX or Matthew Chedagas, it's going to be something that we can trust as having been properly vetted, which is a
To
problem
make
in this
sure it's right
topic.
before we put it out there. That's really true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the
So, I
other night,
mean,
actually, we had another success like this the other night.
okay.
Cecilia Levy, another professor at UAlbany who works with us, she messaged me and sent me a picture of a short video of an object she saw in the sky, a bright dumbbell-shaped object she saw in the sky, and she said it was moving. And she sent it to me, and I saw it, and I watched it, and I was like, that looks like a rocket. I've seen videos of rockets, and I actually saw a rocket launch once in Northern California, or a missile launch in Northern California, and I was like, that looks like a rocket. And I messaged her back, and then we looked into it, and it turned out there was a Vulcan rocket that had been launched from Cape Canaveral. And then I thought, well, yes, you could see that, but I said, but which, so I messaged her, but which way did you see it? Where in the sky was it? Which way was it going? And she goes, it was in the northwest and it was heading north. And I was like, that can't be the Vulcan rocket. The Vulcan rocket was launched in Florida and headed east out over Africa. So from Albany, you're going to see it in the southeast. Are you sure it wasn't the southeast or south? And she goes, no, I'm sure it was the northwest heading north. And by that time, we both kind of settled on the idea. This is where a skeptic deviates, right? A skeptic goes, well, clearly it's a rocket. There was a rocket launch that you saw it in the sky. There was a rocket, right? And we were like, yeah, but it doesn't quite fit. It isn't a good fit. It's in the wrong place. And it was about an hour later, too. It was like, there's no way that thing, it's going into a standard orbit. It's a 90-minute orbit. That thing would have been over the Pacific by the time she would have been seeing it. So that didn't work. And it really bothered me. And so the next morning, I messaged her right away when I woke up. And I said, can you go outside and verify the direction you saw it moving in? Because it doesn't all fit together in my head. And so she went and measured, checked it again. She goes, no, I'm sure it was the northwest headed north. And looked into it, and we found out that there was actually an Ariane rocket launched from Guyana in South America into a polar orbit sometime later that same day, and that flew right over New York, flew over the Midwest to the U.S., and would have been right where she saw it in the same heading. And then we pieced it together. We were like, ah, it wasn't the Vulcan rocket; it was the Ariane rocket. So we had, and in fact, our local newspaper actually published that that thing you everybody saw in the sky was the Vulcan rocket. It actually wasn't. The picture they had in the newspaper wasn't. That was the Ariane rocket. But that was a great. I was really proud of our team again because we didn't just latch on to the first prosaic explanation that kind of worked, right? Which is what a skeptic does all the time. We realized that doesn't fit all the data. You have to describe all the data, right? And that's where the eyewitness testimony comes in handy. I mean, she saw the thing heading north from northwest to north, and I trust that my colleague knows north from south. And so I have to believe that that couldn't have been the Vulcan rocket.
And the further research showed exactly what it was.
And we figured out what it was, which is what the whole goal is. So it was very good.
In the history of UAPX, what do you think are the most anomalous results that you've gotten so far? Is there anything that stands out as particularly mysterious?
The hole in the clouds is really weird.
Still?
The hole in the clouds that you see in a tear in the sky is really
strange.
Yeah,
okay.
There are little white dots in that photo, in the video that we have. It's not a bug on the... It's not a bug on the lens. It's not water evaporated. It's none of that. I did correlation plots. It's the hole in the clouds is correlated with the rest of the sky. Mm-hmm. Something made a hole in the clouds, and there were about 54 little white dots in the hole. And if you measure the size of the white dots, they're about the same size as the Tic Tacs.
Yeah. Wow.
That were observed in the Nimitz. So
there's
we don't
a cluster
know.
Of these
We're
things.
Probably
yeah.
never going to know what happened there. We're never going to know for sure what it was. They weren't seagulls. They were big. At that altitude of the hole, they would have been about 40 feet long.
Yeah.
So,
interesting.
So that was the most, that was a strange thing we saw. It was also correlated with some radiation measurement, some high energy particles were detected by our particle detectors. So
what kind of particles, or is it
we don't know what kind of particles they were. Probably gamma rays or something like that was in that energy range. It was a high,
and that's pretty high odd energy. Right, I mean, to have
it's
like
very odd. It was within the same minute that happened. So
wow, same minute. Okay.
Yeah.
Now one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I know that you have a friendship or a relationship with Beatrice Villarreal and Vasco's work, that seems really exciting. Can you tell us a little bit about what you know of that? I mean, and how you view it? I mean, it seems to me that there's transients in the sky that are there for a little bit, and then they disappear before we ever had any kind of travel up in space that would explain it by terrestrial means. And they disappear when they're in shadow. So they, I mean, yeah. How do you see it?
That is tough. I find it intriguing and it's interesting.
Yeah.
And the difficulty is that you're getting snapshots of lights in the sky, and you can very rarely get a lot of information about a light in the sky.
Yeah.
So it's hard. I wish we had more information, more data. Some of the things that she reports are interesting. I worry about the possibility of there being artifacts on the photographic plates. And so that has to be looked at very carefully just to double check and make sure. But I think it's a brilliant idea for a project, and I wish her success. And I think it's one of those brilliant ideas that you have data collected by other astronomers that potentially shows something unusual, which won't be so easily discounted by the scientific community. So I think that's makes it important as well.
It's interesting that there's correlations with some dates where, like, I guess the DC
July,
overflight
like the
of
1952 Washington flyover. Yeah, there are date correlations, and that's interesting too. So yeah, I think this needs to be looked at very carefully.
But like, Evan, I get what you're saying with the lights in the sky thing, because if it's a there's not a whole lot of ways to get more information about what it is you're looking at. And so even though you may
Exactly.
have evidence that it's there, there's no further steps you can take to kind of quantify what that is or determine its nature,
Right.
other than, wondering at it. But I mean, I think that it does demonstrate this creative thinking that happens in this topic sometimes, where people are like trying to find ways to substantiate the existence of these weird phenomenon and do it in a way that's sort of beyond typical dismissal from skeptics. And that's one way to there was no nothing else in the sky or in space at that point that could have explained some of this stuff. So that would be a
Right, which
hard
makes it very compelling, right? That's exciting. Yeah.
Now, what do you think? I mean, in terms of like one of the things that's been a hot topic recently is the Galileo project with the new interstellar traveler that's coming.
With Atlas coming through, yeah.
And there has been some criticism of Avi Loeb saying once again he jumps on the alien bandwagon. It seems to me that from my perspective, he's not jumping on the alien bandwagon as much as making sure that that remains an option for explanation. But do
He
you think that's the
wants to
case?
keep the
And
hypothesis on the table, and that's where it belongs. It belongs on the table. It belongs in people's minds. People need to consider that the possibility that somebody might send a probe into our solar system is a real possibility. That's all. I think that's all. That's really all he's saying. And I think that, and he gets criticized for it quite a bit, but I think that, but that's a real possibility that people need to be aware of. Now, is this object different than other comets? Yes, it's different from other comets. That makes it more interesting, of course. Does it make it an alien probe? Well, maybe not. Maybe it's not inconsistent with the hypothesis as an alien probe, but so maybe that's interesting. I think I really agree with his assertion that the Juno probe, which is slated to dive into Jupiter's atmosphere to destroy it and collect some data on the way down. I think that the Juno probe is an excellent opportunity. I look at the state of space travel at this point, and we really ought to have probes all over the solar system ready to observe whatever we happen to see. We ought to be able to catch up to these things. We ought to be able to make spacecraft that can catch up to interstellar objects. That would be excellent. But the fact that the Juno probe is positioned and could be used to fly by this thing, we should do it. Not because it might be an alien probe, but because instead because it is one would have been would be the first interstellar object that we would have ever flown by and looked at.
Yeah, sound
That's
science no
why
matter
we
what.
should study it.
Yeah, it
Not
sounds
because
science no matter what.
Avi thinks it might be an alien probe. And I don't think and like I said, it's not that he thinks that, it's that he wants to keep that hypothesis on the table, and that's fine. But that's not the reason for flying by it. We should fly by it because it's an interstellar object and we should check it out.
Yeah, one of the things that's been going on that everyone's sort of been noticing is the NASA has been going through a whole lot of upheaval through budget cuts and whatnot. I know that you've worked with
The NASA
NASA
grant that we're always waiting for it to be cut. I
and
mean, it's so
the
far not. So far
so
not.
far
So
not.
far not. So
But I mean,
yep.
if I was just going to ask, basically, I mean, like sending the Juno probe would require some quick thinking and some, I don't know what you want to call it, but an ability to kind of evolve to the science in a hard and fast way.
Yeah.
In your experience at this moment, is that something that could be accomplished, or
Oh, NASA scientists, top. When I worked at NASA, they were the best people I've ever worked with. Smartest group of people I've ever worked with. I have no doubt that they're capable. If they wanted to do it, they could do it. The question is, is there going to be a drive, and is the administration going to let them do it? That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, so it, once again, it becomes a political question, and we'll see how it.
It's more of that.
Yeah. Now,
Fully
one.
capable, though. I have no doubt that they could pull it off, and it would be amazing if they did. I truly hope that they do. I mean, because these objects aren't like our comets. So what are they? And what
Yeah.
we need to learn about these things so that we can tell them apart from other things. So we know when one of these is coming through, we know it's not an alien spacecraft because we know that it's this
We
type
know what
of
it
object.
is. Yeah,
Something.
yeah.
Yeah.
And they're going super fast. They're coming from outside the solar system. I mean, this one's trajectory is sort of bizarre in terms of how it's approaching. There's a lot of
Yeah.
things that are anomalous about it. So sending a probe like the Jupiter probe or the Juno probe would be worthwhile, even if it is not an alien spacecraft. And I think that
This
Congresswoman
is the
Luna
third
mentioned that.
interstellar object in like what, 5 years or something. So how
Yeah.
many of these things come through our solar system, and what are they all like, and what is the population of interstellar objects in interstellar space? We don't know anything about that. And there are so many great opportunities here.
I mean, does the fact that it's the third, does that represent a sudden explosion in these things, or are we just now noticing them, to your mind?
I suspect we're just starting to notice.
Yeah. Is there some change in the
Can't rule that
technology
out.
that's
I
it?
can't rule that out, so I would
Yeah.
think that that's probably it.
Would you think it's a, like a change in the technology over time, or what would make it so that we can suddenly pick these things out?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd have to look into that more to be sure, but I suspect that we're paying more attention.
Yeah. Okay. And we're going to take another break here for the paid subscribers. We'll come back and dive a little bit deeper into Professor Knuth's personal experiences with the phenomenon.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Streber. I'm Whitley Streber, your host for Dreamland.